Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, and welcome to another edition of Press One for Democracy. This is your host, Dan Aronson, coming to you live from Portland, Oregon, along the banks of the beautiful Willamette River, right across the Rose Garden in beautiful downtown Portland, home of 42 wonderful microbreweries, the most in any city in the world. Loving life in Portland. You should always all come and visit me soon. I have an interesting show tonight, I think, and but I got a lot of actual kind of setup work that I've got to do to explain the day that we had at the coffee party. So we had a very interesting, let's call it editorial mishap. Not on our part. It wasn't really on our part, but it was on the part of, I can only imagine, some person at Facebook. Who decided that an article that we posted that was actually an extremely heartwarming article, wonderful article, one that everybody should read, and I've actually already posted up in the chat room. it was an article about an African-American musician who befriended several members of the KKK during the 80s and actually became close friends with them, and actually got many of them to give up their participation in the KKK. Now, I can only assume, again, because, you know, there is no board of inquiry at Facebook. They're not going to give you the ability to, there's no court of appeal here. But I just want to give you a little bit of what this article is about. The headline of the article was, KKK member walks up to black musician in bar, but it's not a joke, and what happens next will astound you. And again, it then goes into depth on this gentleman's life, Daryl Davis, a musician who is a very actually well-traveled and somewhat famous musician who actually went ahead and struck up a conversation and eventually a friendship with a member of the KKK and eventually got him and others to understand that what they were being told in the KKK about black people and other minorities were simply not true. And after getting to know them, he was successful doing that. But I can only imagine that somebody flagged that message, some reader flagged the message as inappropriate without reading it, and then somebody from Facebook also flagged the message as inappropriate without reading it and decided to shut down our admin's capability of posting for 12 hours. So I was not able to post the show announcement, other members were involved and other members were angered. But I actually have a gentleman here who's on hold, who I know he wants to talk to me about tonight's show and the actual topic of tonight's show, which is what will the Democrats bring in 2014? But I want to bring him in early because somehow Mr. Egberto Willis was able to post on our main page, and I want to know how you did that, my friend.
What happened? Oh, yeah. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Yeah. Actually, I didn't get any privileges that you didn't have. What happened, I think, is that your 12 hours starts from the time you realize that there was a block on your account, because Annabelle got access before I did, and my hunch was that she got she realized that we were blocked early on. So I don't think, there was no special provisions that gave me access before you did.
Ah, so you're saying when you logged on and it said, do you want to take down this bad stuff from your site and clean it up? And you said no, and then you were told you were blocked for 12 hours for daring to say no to a great and powerful Facebook. That's when your clock starts. I see what you're saying. Okay.
I am making that assumption. I don't know for sure, but just given what has happened empirically, that's what it seems like. Because Cashin also didn't get access to way after me, and he got his access at 4, and that's when he realized that he was offline for 12 hours before then.
All right, there you go. Well, mystery solved. It makes absolutely perfect sense to me. Now, I want to go ahead and set up the show and then bring you back in. Do you have time for me
okay.
to do the setup?
Yeah, go set it up.
All right, excellent. I'll set up the show. Let me mute you here for a second just in case there's some background noise. I'm going to set up the show and bring you right back in. So if you didn't recognize that voice, folks, that was Egberto Willis. He is the host of Politics Done Right, a coffee party show that airs Saturdays at 1 p.m., Eastern Standard Time, and noon Central Time, and 10 a.m. out here for us on the West Coast. And we love to get up early, have our cup of coffee, and hang out with Egberto and talk politics. And I think you'll understand, if you know Egberto, why he's keen to talk to me. So let me show you the email that what I want to do is read from the email to set up the show, because this is what would have been posted in Facebook and what would have set up the show. So for those of you listening and online, and also, of course, callers, please call in at 646-929-2495 so you can be part of the show. But here is what the main topic is. The article was 2014, the post was 2014 midterms, what are our choices? As the 2014 midterm elections draw near, some choices seem fairly clear, others not so much. Looking strictly at their approaches to the economy, the Republicans remain entrenched in their position of shrinking government and helping the so-called job creators, and I'm doing the quotes, the so-called job creators, grow us out of our doldrums. But what solutions are the Democrats offering? A New York Times piece published on Saturday pointed to the fact that Democrats, led by the president himself, are wary of promoting what have been long-time Democratic values, or at least one value in particular. The article centered on passing over of Rebecca Blank as a leader for the president's Council of Economic Advisers because she had dared to use the word redistribution in a 1992 research paper on poverty. The fact is, there was a day when Democrats proudly displayed redistribution as a centerpiece of their economic policy. And still today, the more progressive wing of the party would love nothing more than to see their champions embrace it, beginning with increased tax rates on the wealthiest Americans. However, when the president himself openly denies the word redistribution in defense of the ACA, what are we to think? Here's a telling quote from a stump speech the president gave in Elyra, Ohio, during his reelection campaign. The president said, "This is not about taking from rich people to give to poor people. This is about us together making investments in our country so everybody gets a fair shot." And I'm going to go ahead and post into the chat room just so everybody can view that entire article, the link to it. Naturally, now, and of course in the president's defense, there's no reason to believe that this will ever happen as long as Republicans hold sway in the House. However, the question still remains, will the Democrats campaign during their next cycle on tax hikes for the wealthy? Or are they too afraid that the wealthy would turn their backs on them when it comes time to fundraise? Will they call for a Wall Street transaction tax, or instead conceal their desire for fear that Wall Street firms will refuse to fill their campaign coffers? In short, has the corruption of Washington become so complete that the Democrats are selling out their base in order to woo big businesses and the wealthy, a.k.a. people who we would normally identify as Republican supporters? So that was my concern and my worry, because as people have known who are regular listeners to the show, I have said for many, many moons that we need to have more progressive taxation in order to repair the damage that was done, the redistribution that has been done. There has been a redistribution in this country. It's been happening for 30 years, but it's been taking from the bottom and passing it to the top. And we need politicians who are willing to come forward and say, we are going to fix that. We are going to level the playing field, and we are going to give back what was wrongfully taken from the middle class and lower classes. And I'm going to open Egberto's mic, and I'm going to guess he's kind of in agreement with that.
You know, what is bothersome is that we are just about always in agreement, except when we have to speak about this relative to parties. Let me give an example of what I'm talking about. When you say that the president has is the president abandoning his base by not accepting the word redistribution? I would have to answer that. I'd say he's doing that, and he has to do that for political reasons, because over the years we have allowed the corruption of words like redistribution. We have allowed the corruption of words like liberals. We have allowed the corruption of all these words. So now there are code words that prevent a real dialogue to take place. That is why in my posting today, I actually said, and I don't know if you actually read the entire post that I did, where I actually said it's time for progressives to be convicted just as much as conservatives have been to their point of view. The difference.
I read it in its entirety. I read it in its entirety, and as a letter, an open letter to the Democratic Party and anybody who's considering running and anybody who's supporting the Democratic Party, I thought it was brilliant.
Right. Okay, but let me tell you better. When I wrote most of it, you would notice that it never mentioned parties. Initially, it was talking about progressives. In other words, progressive never used to be a thing that was simply democratic. It used to be there were, in fact, if we want to be honest about it, back in the 60s, the progressive wing of the Republican Party was instrumental of a lot of good that actually got done with civil rights and other issues. So the problem now is that we've gotten this huge separation that it is all, if you want to talk policy successful for the middle class, it is almost only within one party at this point in time, not necessarily going, in some future time, but in this point, at this point in time, it has to go through the Democratic Party. Now, you made mention in the email that you sent me, I think you sent me a Heritage Foundation document that I have to tell you must be disregarded. You also sent me, and I'll tell if you want, I can say.
Sent you a Heritage Foundation? If I sent you a Heritage Foundation document, it certainly was not on purpose. It was certainly not on purpose.
My fault. It's not Heritage. It's National Review, which is
definitely conservative in nature. That is correct.
Exactly.
But it's quoting the president. But it was quoting the president's own staff. I mean,
Here's the problem.
But if you care to, I'll join the show on Saturday. We could talk about that then. But
sure.
tie that back in to how the Democrats going to come strong for everything that they believe in, for a real progressive agenda in 2014. What's your feeling?
If you read my paper, they should, because if they do, they would be holding the moral high ground, which, if done appropriately, will create an electoral win. However, what we have, and within that paper that I wrote again, is the fear and lack of conviction for their position. In other words, their position have been so corrupted by the right, and the people in America have so been misinformed that they do not feel they have the ability to simply be the leaders in what they believe, and not only in what they believe, but what have been proven to be successful in every time this country has been successful in building a middle class.
I'm not going to argue with you factually, but I'm going to take one exception to something you said.
Okay.
Yes, the messaging coming from the right is they're doing everything. And 410, I see you on hold there with your hand up. We'll be coming to you right away, as soon as we're done, Gerdo and I are done with this exchange. But so here's my thing. Yes, the people on the right are putting out information that you believe is fictitious. Frankly, to me, any information that is based on a projection of something that's going to happen in the future, other than the sun rising in the east and setting in the west, it might be false, it might be true. We really won't know until the end. However, I will say this. We have to, if we are going to return to a government of the people and for the people and by the people, we have to trust the people that cast their vote right alongside in the booth next to us. We have to trust them that they will listen to both sides and that they will make an informed and intelligent decision. If they don't, and here's the slippery slope, if they don't, democracy as a whole must be called into question as being the best system, because if it's an uninformed and unintelligent electorate, then is that really the best system to elect our government?
And that's a very good question, Dan. And let me tell you, in fact, that is one of the reasons why we didn't want voting in Palestine, because Hamas got voted in. That is the reason. I mean, democracy only works well in a society that is not only informed but is intelligent. Okay, and that's the only time democracy will work in a fashion where you can have a real civil society, a society going forward. If you watch what has been happening in this country, look at what just happened in Texas. No longer do they want algebra to be taught. I mean, we are having a dumbification of the country because the powers that be realize that an intelligent population looks out for the population. That is how democracy works. But if they don't look out for if they're not an intelligent population, you just said we have to trust the person next to us. At this point in time, in Texas, in my town, I don't. And why don't I? Because I know that they are misinformed. You made another statement when you said that you don't believe in things unless they're current and present, meaning projections are just that, projections. That is true. However, we can put two projections together, and one can be based on likely events, and one can be based on impossible events. Trickle-down economics was based on impossible events. Stimuli-type redistribution is based on practical, factual events. And here's the funny thing about it. We have 30 years of trickle-down economics that we can use as history as far as the outcome. We also have from 45 with the Great Society. From Roosevelt. From Roosevelt right up to the 70s, we've seen what happened to the middle class, which was redistribution. And we see that it works, and it works because we know the multiplicative effect of money. So it's not like we don't have history to prove what policies work and what don't.
I certainly agree with you, Egberto. If you have a chance and you can stick around, I'd like to leave your mic open while we bring in 410. Let me ask you one simple last question, because the way I ended my post, or would have ended my post that I have posted, is we'll ask our listeners for what's on their economic policy wish list for 2014 and whether they think their respective parties will come through for them. So we know that you're, you know, for a full-force progressive agenda being pushed by the Republicans in 2014 to counteract the do-nothing, shrink government, and let the free markets work that the Republicans are pushing for. Do you think you will get it? Give me a percentage of likelihood.
It is about a 40% of likelihood, and it depends on people like you doing what you do, doing what I do what all the other people that are trying to inform the people do, whether it's successful or not. So you have to play your part too.
Well, I'm all about it every Monday night. All right, Egberto, thank you very much. I'm leaving your mic open. I'm bringing in 410, who, as Egberto would say, and I stole this line from him, I give him all the credit, do we have the pleasure of speaking with?
Hello, this is Alan from Maryland.
Hi, Alan from Maryland. How are you?
Doing good.
Good.
Sounds like you have a good topic off running here. So I think I'll try to help it. I can talk about redistribution in a good way, and I think I can say why you need to do it.
Okay.
Well, if there's only so much money in circulation, there's a finite amount, and unless we're going to spend a lot of time discussing how you add more money into the system or take some out, let's leave that to the side for a minute. But let's just say if this income disparity continues, you're going to see money piling up with certain people to the extent where they can't spend it fast enough to put it back into the economy. What do you think?
Well, I think we're already there. I think the amount of wealth that the top 1% of this country holds is insane. I mean, you could fit 100 people couldn't spend it in 100 lifetimes. So yeah,
sure,
I think as far as income inequality and wealth inequality, I think we're there.
So we've isolated a factual circumstance.
Absolutely.
All right. Now, if what's going on is it's called the capital strike, and that is the wealthy clique refuses to put the money back into the economy until they get what they want on their wish list, politically. You see what I mean?
They're necessarily refusing to do it because of that, but they're certainly taking a good chunk of it and spending it to buy influence necessary to get what they want.
Right, but in a certain sense, they're not spending it. They're sitting on it. In other words, you could say that there are corporations across the country sitting on large amounts of liquid assets, and they're not doing anything with it. They're not reinvesting.
I could say that not only are they sitting on it, but it's not sitting here in a bank in the United States where it could be lent to small businesses as business loans, or it could be lent to college students at reasonable rates. It's sitting in Ireland and in other low-tax havens, and then, of course, personally in their banks in the Caymans, where they can't even get taxed, so we can't even get a piece of it to help.
Sure,
let alone a good chunk of it reinvested.
Right, things like that and lots of other things. Same categories. All right, so it's a moral imperative that portion of our currency has to be redirected into the economy. And a high tax bracket for high income earners is moral and necessary. So
on the basis of morality.
On the basis of the need for a redirection, let's call it redirection. We need to redirect those funds and assets into the economy because they're being sat on.
Okay, so let me play devil's advocate.
I'm being kind.
Egberto wants to say.
Yeah, let me say one thing. Because a lot of people always think, well, I earned this, it's mine. Why should you be asking for something that I've earned? There's another blog I would love folks to read where it's called What Are You Worth? In other words, who said that person who moved money around is worth more than my garbage man or garbage woman?
True.
Okay, who says that person who works in that donut shop is worth that little, while that person who reads the news on TV is worth $1 million a year? So we have a disjointed way of determining worth that has nothing to do with actual survival in this country. I mean, you want to know what's your real worth? Your real worth is how can you survive on your own. And if you take that wealthy person and throw them on an island and throw that farmer on that island, I bet that farmer survives and that wealthy person dies. Who is really worth more? So whenever we start talking about redistribution and taking these people's money away, my thing is, their money came from an aberration in capitalism,
exactly,
and not because of their worth.
Right. They already mastered the redistribution into their hands. So let's just let that issue lay, because we're not going to accept their argument.
Okay, but here's my problem with, and I'm not disagreeing with you, but again, I love to point out the slippery slopes that we end up stepping on sometimes without thinking about it. When I was young and stupid, I will say it that way, I was very, very conservative. And I say I was stupid because that's what Winston Churchill told me, right? He said, show me a young man who's a conservative and I'll show you somebody with no heart. Show me an old man who's a liberal and I'll show you someone with no brain. So I was kind of reversed. I was not where I should have been. And I trust Churchill because he was a pretty smart dude. But here's the thing. What I didn't want is I didn't want people legislating morality. I don't want the government to tell me what I can do in my bedroom. I don't want them to tell me what religion, what I can or can't do with my religious freedoms. I don't want them to tell women, especially a bunch of, you know, 95%, a group of 95% old white guys, to tell women whether they can or can't have an abortion. That's not the problem. Once you start legislating on morality basis, it opens up a whole other can of worms.
That's not the type of morality we're talking about here. We're talking about a different kind of morality. We're talking about the constitutional imperative directed to the Congress to make commerce, to effectively implement a money system. And it's the moral imperative of the Congress to take charge of redistributing currency, which is not wealth per se, but it's the command of wealth to have currency in your hand. Okay. Now, if this currency piles up...
Can I ask a quick question before you go on?
This is a different kind of morality, my good friend Bob Woodward...
Because he's the show's constitutional scholar. Can you please point me to that? Because I want to know, just so I can make a proper argument. Because I'd rather make it from a constitutional standpoint than a moral standpoint.
Show me
what you're talking about in the Constitution that says.
Sure, but
the government
agree. We're talking about a different kind of morality. We're not talking about some Bible thumper's idea of what is good or bad. We're talking about a constitutional morality. It's different.
Okay.
Right.
And tell me which parts of the Constitution demand that of Congress.
Well, Article 1 that sets up the Congress, the legislative branch, covers most of this. But
okay.
How about if we take the discussion up a notch and start talking about derivatives, and we're talking about fictitious capital gains, and then we're talking about the pegging of a monetary value behind those fictitious capital gains. They're bought and sold, and then there's fictitious capital gains drawn from those from that buying and selling. So the derivatives market is creating money out of thin air that means nothing.
Well, you're talking about Alberto. I know this is your sweet spot. Go for it,
brother.
There you
go, Alberto. Take it away.
Well, yeah. Alan, you're correct about the thing about derivatives. Unfortunately, while you call it imaginary money, I call it money stolen from the middle class. Because in effect, when that caved, where did the money come from?
Okay, I can explain this.
No,
first you've
got
to distinguish between financial instruments and monetary instruments.
Oh, I understand them well.
Okay, but do this for the listeners because the listeners need to understand that the so-called increases of financial instruments are a balloon. They're a bubble, and it's doing it on its own. Now, when those guys call due their profit, then we need to create monetary instruments to make their – in other words, they can't cash out unless we create more money in the system for them to do it. That's
right.
What most people don't understand. So
not
in
a
effect,
problem, but I guess
in effect, we're they're being the way the middle class and the poor folks are being robbed and looted is a different set of problems. We're not investing in ourselves, but what is going on in the financial world is they're creating a runaway thing. You have to put a stop to it. And that's the transactions tax on the Wall Street turnover is a great way to go after this.
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree with what you're saying at all. And you know what you're saying is actually true. However, when it comes to these financial instruments that you're talking about, I don't know.
They have to be outlawed. They have to be outlawed. The derivatives have to be outlawed.
Yes, but what we have to explain to people is why. There was an article,
yes,
and I don't remember who wrote the article. And what the article said is America used to be, I don't remember, 20-something or 30-something percent manufacturing base, meaning we made things. We got a lot of percentage of our wealth from making things. Edison made things, okay? Now, we don't make things anymore. We make money, and it's only a few that make money from money. So, in effect, we have a semblance of wealth, but we don't really have wealth because we make nothing. So all the wealth that you
are
accumulating, it is not based on having turned over raw material into or added value onto raw material. So what that means is, as the caller exactly stated, it is a bubble waiting to be busted. Now, there's this, I don't remember the name of, Hartman. Hartman has a new book out where he claims or he believes if things don't change, we're on a trajectory for 2016 for the whole house of cards that would have likely fallen pre-bailout will likely be falling in 2016 for these specific reasons.
So
but
he was
you have another
just,
fallout.
He was just here in Portland Friday night at Paul's
right.
bookstore, and I wanted to go so badly and meet him, but I had a hockey game I had to go to.
I hear you,
but
friend.
Yeah, it's called the Tom Hartman, Thomhartman. It's called The Crash of 2016. He is. You would think he would be a perfect member, a charter member of the Coffee Party, like Robert
yes.
Reich, like everybody else with any with two working brain cells. He's saying we got to get the money out of politics, or else forget about it. We're done. So, I like him. He's got a syndicated radio show. And, I'm now on his email list. So, yeah, I really like Hartman and what he's got to say. Alan, I apologize. I had to mute you because we were getting a lot of background noise from your phone. Sorry, Alberto. I hope I didn't cut you off mid-sentence.
Oh, no, you didn't at all. I was just going to – I think you have another caller.
I do. Oh, you're right. You're right. So, Alan, if you want to go ahead and press 1, then your hand will go down, and then you can press 1 again, and your hand will go up, and we can get you back into the show. But right now we have area code 206, our good friend from north of the border here in Washington. Who do we have the pleasure of speaking with?
Hi there. My name's Bob.
Hi, Bob. And you're calling from the Seattle area, I'm guessing.
I am. Although that can be deceiving when you have a cell phone, because cell phones can travel when people move. I am calling outside of Seattle.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to tell me you were in, like, Florida or something.
No, but that is total reality with a cell phone. So
yeah,
keep that in mind for other times.
So how are things in Seattle? You guys got even with us the other night. I was kind of angry, although it was a great game. That's I don't know if you follow the Thunderbirds at all, the junior hockey team.
Oh, no, I'm a hardcore Husky, University of Washington Husky fan myself. And I was pretty happy with the total blowout down there at Reister Stadium. But, I don't watch a whole lot of hockey. I do watch a little NHL when it gets to playoff time. My personal choice is I like the Boston Bruins, so...
You and I are just not going to be sports friends, because you're from the place where our biggest rival in our major junior hockey league is, and I'm a Blackhawks fan because I'm from Chicago. So
okay. Well, see,
I bet we could agree on politics.
Last year it was a great series with the Hawks. I like the Blackhawks and Boston. I mean, those are some of the original NHL teams. That's why I kind of like all those guys. So, but I liked what the person from Maryland was talking about, and I always think back to, well, I don't think back to, but I was glad you guys brought up Tom Hartman, because Tom Hartman's talked about this, and I think one of his books, he talks about it pretty clearly, and that was when they first set up this country a long time ago, but way back when, and they came over from England, and it seemed to me like people like, I think it was Jefferson was one of the leader type guys, and there were other guys that believed this too. You guys can correct me if you think I'm incorrect, but they said, we don't want aristocracies. We don't want people to hoard money, control money, and never have money, never to go back into the system. You know, it's, I always thought that's sort of what we left when we left England, because we got tired of beating on the castle wall, asking for a job, and the job that you were given was just a garbage job of which was getting no pay, and the rich got richer, and they enjoyed everything, and that's what aristocracy is. And I think we've moved back to an aristocracy ever since Reagan came along. And I think the idea that these guys set up, when you're saying you're not sure where it was in the Constitution, I think it resides in that area. Can clear it up exactly, but that area that says that Congress has the right to tax, and I think they have the right to tax because that's what's going to stop an aristocracy from growing. And I think that's what we've been having for the last 30 years. We've turned into an aristocracy. We've turned into a country. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say I couldn't agree with you more, and I know Egberto's only got a couple more minutes to hang out with us, so I thought I'd let him get his comment or two in on what you're saying.
Yeah.
Well, I have to say is that you get some very intelligent callers, man. People that know what's going on. I just wish that all these people that understand these policies would be out there not only talking at your coffee shops and your grocery stores, but come on to the Facebook and even our Facebook page at Coffee Party USA. Join Coffee Party USA and actually put this out there, because one of the problems I find, and I think, Dan, you see that as well, is that a lot of people that speak what we're speaking about a lot of times don't get that message out, and we're not doing any favors to our fellow citizens when we don't let them know these truths, because nobody, the mainstream media, the traditional media is not doing it, so we have to do it. So I hope, and like I said, Dan, you have some great callers. I got to leave now, but thank you, first of all, for giving me a chance to speak on your show, and you get some great callers. I'll talk to you on Saturday if you call in.
Okay, we'll do, Egberto. Thanks.
Okay.
So the only thing I would add to what Egberto just said is this. It's not enough, and this is kind of, I think, my underlying and overlying and overriding goal and my underlying mantra and overlying goal. It's not enough, Bob, and you are right. You're absolutely right. But it's not enough to be right. And if we are going move forward within the and get to where we all really want to go, we unfortunately or fortunately, either one, it's about the way you deliver the message. A good friend of mine used to say the same thing, and I thought this was so clever. He said, "You can tell somebody to go to hell, but if you tell them the right way, they'll have packed their bags and be looking forward to the trip." And I think
I agree
that's
with that.
What's missing. You and I can sit here and have this nice discussion, an intelligent discussion, and back and forth, and it doesn't, you know, nobody's using labels, nobody's calling names, nobody's getting their panties in a wad. You know, we're just having this conversation.
Well,
And that's the truth of it. And
well, I agree. I most certainly enjoy a good conversation. And I will mention this as a disclaimer. I am in a master's program for library information science. And, you know, that's the cornerstone. Libraries are the cornerstone of our First Amendment information access in the 21st century. We call it information literacy, how to access information, quality information that's good information. Now, what really disappoints me, and I'm going to actually kind of refute that part about the name calling stuff, because, you know, for the last 30 years or plus, the Democratic Party has been completely torn down, chewed up, spit out, and ruined by the Republican Party. And that's you can go back and look at a lot of different things, how they talked, what they said. I don't know if you ever watch Archie Bunker. 1970, All in the Family. If you go back and
certainly
listen to like 19, okay, you listen to 1970, 71, 72, and 73 season, you could wrap a blindfold around you. You think they're talking about today's issues, 100% across the board, inequality, overpopulation, problems with religion, people not having same-sex marriage, gay rights people getting walked on, minorities getting walked on, complex, you know, a military complex, all those things you would think they're talking about today. But this is what really bothers me the most about the Republican Party, which I think does deserve a few name callings, because it's really ridiculous in my book. For instance, you have Mitch McConnell, and you also have Rand Paul out of Kentucky that have totally been running this ACA, the American, you know, the Affordable Health Care Act, into the ground, saying that Kentucky doesn't want it. Kentucky doesn't want it. I was just watching the news here a little bit ago, and I read quite often. Kentucky signed up like 56,000 people for the ACA. Kentucky is one of the shining stars of states that are getting people into Medicaid, that are getting people signed up for this health care. But if you listen to the two representatives, you would think that Kentucky hates it. And that just isn't the fact. And I think that's a problem. I think that is a moral issue. I think that they're not being truthful to the people. They're not being truthful to anybody at the national stage. They get on TV, they get on the Sunday shows, and they say these things. They get on the TV whenever they can, and they say those things, and those things just aren't true. The people in Kentucky are buying into it. I mean, they showed a map of Kentucky during the 2012 election. I think Obama won like three districts, and the whole thing was blue. I mean, the whole thing was red, Kentucky. So you'd almost think, well, hey, Kentucky, you know, they're a bunch of conservatives, although they have a Democratic governor, but they sure vote pretty conservative. You listen to their leadership at the federal level, and you think that they hate the ACA, when in fact that's not true. That's what I think the problem is with the Republican Party.
So
I
hear you, and again, Bob, I'm not going to disagree with you, because what you're telling me is truthful. However,
right.
I don't see how people say it's a one-way, it's a one-sided issue, because at the same time, and I wrote, there was a little bit more to my back and forth with Egberto that was pre-show and a couple of the things
uh-huh.
that I took exception to some of the things he's written in basically saying they're lying. Because the fact of the matter is that economists, Democratic economists, have totally discounted this notion that the ACA has already reduced healthcare costs. Healthcare cost is down, but no economist has said, yes, it's because of the ACA. They say, nah, it's not that. It hasn't had time to take effect. It's because mm-hmm. of the economic slowdown, and there's less spending in general on healthcare, and any claims that say that the ACA has already reduced healthcare costs are false. Now, I looked on Google for hours, and I could not find somebody to say otherwise. So, and here's the thing. The only people who are saying otherwise are the White House. The White House says it's working. The White House says, well, give me an independent source, an economist, who says, yes, this has.
Okay. I agree with you. You go onto Google, you're not going to find too many case studies that are being produced by professors, especially over something that's gone on for 3 years. Let me give you a...
Well, I have one of those too, it's much worse.
Well,
I have one of those too, and it's,
you know,
much worse.
Well, what? Okay. Well, then let's go to something that's on the record then, and it's been on the record for a while. When did Massachusetts put their system in? How many years ago? I know it's only at the state.
2006.
Okay, it's only at the state.
Yep.
I think that would give you a better indication at the state level and what it did at the state level than trying to suggest, hey, you know, at the federal level, this has been in effect for, I believe, 3 years. But do you think that anybody's going to want to give back my three main ideas with the ACA? I don't know if it's done much for cost, but kids that can stay on until they're 26,
mm-hmm.
that helps. Okay, that's a good deal. If the insurance company doesn't spend, 80% of your premium, they have to send a rebate check back. I don't think people
mm-hmm.
want that to go back the other way.
Okay, all right. Let me. You know what? Hold on. Let me stop you for a second, just in case I've not explained myself well enough. What I'm not talking about healthcare costs for individuals. What I'm talking about is spending, the growth of spending in healthcare that has been steadily increasing since the 50s, and that's eating up a bigger and bigger portion of our GDP. That's what they said. That's part of what they said the ACA was going to help curb. And not only is it not going to, the president's people say it won't. The president's people say, but hold on one second. The president's people say by 2017, there'll be 20 million people without insurance. The president's people say, and I'm going to give you the, I'll give you the link to Professor Gerald Friedman, who spoke about this in 2010. They know it's going to fail. They know only a single payer system will work. They know this thing is going to fail.
You know, I would agree with that. I would agree with the single payer system. But listen, don't climb on the Democrats for the ACA. The ACA was written by the Heritage Foundation in response to Clinton's single payer idea. This was a Republican conservative idea. Put the money into the public or into the private sector. The federal government will subsidize it. That was written by the Heritage Foundation when Romney signed that. A Heritage Foundation man was on the stage applauding, and they also came out and said, this will be the model for the rest of the nation. This isn't a Democratic idea. This is a conservative idea. It was written by the Heritage Foundation, and it was written by the Heritage Foundation in response to the single-payer system. I think that the Republican Party is just upset because a Democrat, and it happened to be this particular gentleman, a Democrat, who implemented. That's what they're angry about.
So if it works, then we have to give the Republicans all the credit? I'm so confused. If it doesn't work, we have to.
I don't see how you can be confused. It's a Republican conservative idea. If you study the history and find out who wrote it, they wrote it. That's a fact.
I hear
that's
you.
All there is
so it's their fault if it fails, and it's their fault if it succeeds.
No, I'm not saying that it's not going to succeed. Actually, I believe that it's going to work quite well. It would be working a lot better if we had states that would have, instead of, you know, that was one thing why Kentucky has been successful. They got on the ground and got involved. They got small businesses involved. They got word of mouth involved. They got people on the ground. They got people helping people set up. They got their exchange up and running. They did very well. All the other exchanges that aren't happening in this country, those are a product of the Republicans who don't want it to work. Those are Republican governors that said, we're not going to get on the federal exchange. We'll set up our own. Or no, excuse me. They said, no, we're not going to set up a federal or a state exchange. We'll just jump on the federal one. The Fed said that they would have been more than happy to come out and pay for those, or at least help supplement payment to get those state exchanges up and running. But the lazy Republican governors didn't want to do that. They didn't. And, you know, what happened? Jeez, my gosh, systems crashed. I mean, hey, when you got a billion people slamming into a server and servers, what do you expect? I mean, you know, they've totally hamstrung this thing from the beginning. 3 years ago, they've been talking about it. What kills me about the Republican Party is they've voted 42 times to dismember this thing, yet how many guys have bothered writing any kind of legislation? Nobody.
Oh,
I
agree.
Mean, nobody has written one piece of legislation in 3 years to do anything. I mean, you got to be kidding me. It's like, that's what you guys are doing? The House is only working for 13 days between November and December. 13 days. They go up.
Okay,
they stand
so if you don't mind, because I'm not disagreeing with anything you're saying. So if you don't mind, you've just given us a perfect entree to talk about tonight's show topic, which is what do you expect Democrats to come out with on the once they hit the campaign trail in 2014 as far as their economic plan to turn around this country from where we're at and to get things going in the right direction.
This is how I feel about it. This is the year 2013. We spend $700 billion plus a year on military spending. It goes up year after year after year after year. It goes up. It just keeps going up. I don't understand why. The collected tax that we've collected, I think, is at a 30-year low. So 13, 3, 93, 83? You got to go back to 1983 or 19 in the 1970s, I think I've even heard, that our collections for taxes are at that low. So we're trying to fund an economy with 375 million people, the largest military on the planet, and we're trying to fund that with 1970s taxes. I think you know where I'm going with this. First of all, my first idea would be, let's implement a small tax on Wall Street, like a 0.0001% would be great. That would be hauling in revenue. The bottom line, I don't want I do not want aristocracy. I want our companies and businesses like Boeing and Weyerhaeuser and General Electric and all the rest of them, I want them to start paying taxes. They don't have a problem going overseas and paying, 6%, 8% or whatever it is. And by the way, when those companies, like when they operate and they are paying a little bit of tax in those countries, that means they're supporting those countries.
I was just wondering if you wouldn't mind knocking on their doors and collecting the back taxes since they're up in your neck of the woods, those companies you mentioned, at least
two
of them.
Boeing, for sure, yeah, I agree. Hey, I agree. We just got through giving one of the largest tax cuts, I think they said ever, to Boeing, and that just got signed here a little while ago. Last week or the week before. Yeah, I don't have a problem with that. I just about fall off my chair when I hear somebody say, oh, but taxes in America are so high for companies, they pay 31%. Look, okay, here's my first name. Only a moron running a business would be paying 31%. Nobody pays 31%. Nobody. After all the write-offs and all the other things that are at your disposal, nobody's paying no 31%. And yet, a guy like Mitch McConnell will get on TV and say, taxes are the lowest or the highest in the world here in America. You can't expect businesses to operate here in America at 31%. I mean,
that's
on.
A pretty good Mitch McConnell.
that's
librarian and stand-up comedian. I love it. So here's my question. Here's my question, and then I believe our friend from Maryland got back on the line that wants to say something. So here's my question. You want what I want. You want what Egberto wants. Yeah. We want to raise taxes on the wealthy. We want to raise taxes.
Yeah.
We want to tax Wall Street. We want to collect more revenues so that we can turn around. Hopefully
right.
You want it so that we can turn around and start doing the things we need to do in this country, like working on our infrastructure and putting people back to work,
exactly.
Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly.
So we're in agreement.
Exactly.
Now here's my question. 2014's coming. Are you going to get it?
I think, first of all, the House and the Senate needs to be controlled by one party. It looks like that's the only way it's going to work in this country until people figure it out.
Let me ask my question, and I apologize. I didn't ask my question correctly. I'm just talking about when the bell rings and the first either primaries or runoffs or whatever it is or general elections start when they first start campaigning. Will the Democrats come out and campaign on wealth? What is wealth redistribution, and not be scared to call it such?
I know that's a speculative question, and it's a great question. I don't know if it will happen. I'm not sure. Actually, I think it will. In 2012, they ran on the health care. I think the referendum passed. They also ran on, as far as the president, his proposal and idea was, hey, we're going to raise taxes on, people making, I think it ended up being $400,000. So, look, I think if you ask most people say, you got to bring revenue in. It's 2013. I mean, we got to start taxing, getting some taxes into, getting it into the system, like the guy from Maryland said. When everybody's sitting on the money, when the rich people, that money ain't getting spent. They can only go out to dinner so often. You can have 1,000 guys making $80,000 that are out supporting their communities. You got one guy in a family that runs a business. He's making $100 million. How many plates at dinner time can he buy? One. You got 80, 100, 1,000 guys making $80,000. a year, how many dinners can they go out and buy at a restaurant? A hell of a lot. It's a lot better than
I hear
one
you.
Guy
well,
with
you,
all
you,
the money.
You want to hang out, Bob, while we bring our friend
from
Maryland back
in? Oh, did you want me to?
No, I was saying, do you
want to
hang
time.
Out? I'll leave your mic open, and we'll have a three-way.
Oh,
it's scandalous.
Well, I'm
you've
let me talk for a long time, so I better just bow out. I'll be happy to listen for a little while longer, and then I have to do some. I got to do some homework.
All right, no worries.
Thank you so
again,
much.
Thank you, Bob. If you press one, then your hand will go away, and if you want to speak to something specifically again, just press one again and your hand will come back up. But really appreciate it. That's our friend Bob, Mr. Library Sciences from Seattle, Washington area. 410, we're rejoined.
Yeah, hi, Dan. Yeah, and thanks to Bob. And I, likewise, I'll be short because I'd like to give other callers a chance to come on too. Okay, remember last week we talked about the rank and file doesn't really exist the way we need it? Well, we need to grab for political power. Real power grab here. And now, as far as the Wall Street sales tax, it has to be a full 1%. Because remember, if we want to stop these budget cuts, the Republicans are always crying about the debt, right? $17 trillion. Well, there's $1.7 quadrillion turnover on Wall Street, and 1%, that's $17 trillion right there. So it retires the argument that we have to cut the budget on grandma or of the food stamps or the veterans and all these things. So that's the fighting... the rallying cry for this rank and file that we need to have.
So you're thinking 1% and then
a full blast,
debt's gone in a year.
1% tax.
And the debt's gone per year. Within a year, I mean. Debt's gone.
We would have to decide how to apply that revenue. We could decide to pay off the national debt and do nothing else, or we could say 14 years, we'll pay off the national debt. But in the meantime, we'll create schools, we'll build hospitals, we'll finance these magnetically levitated trains that I was talking about last week.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and by the way, call me anytime. Do you need to take down my number, or do you already have it?
I have your number. Yes, your number did come up here.
So
when you say call me anytime,
call me up off the air, or whenever you feel you need to.
Okay.
You know, I can discuss a lot of stuff, and my friends and I with this Wall Street Tax Party, we want to help you on this Trans-Pacific Partnership thing. We want to help you fight that.
Okay,
we've got
that'd
lots
be great.
Of resources.
You know, do me a favor, if you will, send me your full contact information and send it to the show's email address. It's P as in press, you know, P1FD. P, the digit one, and then F and D, Frank David, at Comcast.net.
Okay.
And then we can confab off the air.
Sounds like a great idea.
All right, perfect.
I'll let some other callers go on if they want.
Well, I actually don't have anybody else in queue. I don't know if you have anything else to say, but I could actually do a pause for the cause. And so, again, if you want to go ahead and hit one, and then you'll take your hand down, and then if you want to speak again, feel free to hit one again, and you'll be right back in the queue.
Okay, I'll see you next week.
All right, sounds good. Thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
All right, so far, everybody's in agreement. I would really love to hear from anybody who has got a less progressive bent. I'll even take that. If I have any conservatives on the line, I'd love to hear what you guys are thinking as far as what's happening in 2014. Country is very aggravated at Congress as a whole. I can't tell you exactly what the congressional approval rating was the last time I looked. It bounced between about 10 and 14%. So nobody's really happy. Although Debbie Lynn Molyneux always says, and Debbie Lynn's the co-host on Lunch with Loudon on Thursdays, Debbie Lynn's always saying, you know, everybody disapproves of Congress, but for some reason everybody thinks their congressman is great. So I'm not exactly sure how that's possible. since approximately half think one way and half think the other way, I'm not sure how they disapprove at such a great number. But that always kind of makes me laugh a little bit how people can defend their congressman as being great. And I defend my senators. I know I'm always talking about Wyden and Merkley and how great they are here in Oregon. Actually got a really interesting letter from last week's show, and maybe we'll talk about that in the second half. But for now, let me take a little pause for the cause and bring in our constitutional expert and Coffee Party board member, John Cashin, to give us a little short quip on the Articles of Confederation.
Hello, everyone. This is John Cashin with the Coffee Party USA's Civics Minute. There are many arguments proclaiming the evils of big government, and it always seems to come back to the same arguments made by the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists during the days of our founders concerning the differences between a strong central government and a weak central government. The Second Continental College adopted the Articles of Confederation on November 15, 1777. And it was in place until 1789, but it was replaced by the Constitution, which advocated for a stronger central government. Why was it replaced? The Articles of Confederation maintained the principle that the national government would not hold more power than the states, that which they saw as sovereign. This satisfied the fears that many of the states had regarding a strong central power, as Britain was before the Declaration of Independence. In fact, there was no executive branch, because they feared giving one man that much power, and it was decided that the Congress would handle all the nation's affairs. However, there were many inherent weaknesses with the Articles of Confederation. The national government did not have the power to tax. Congress did not have the power to force states to obey its laws. Congress could not enforce laws. Each state could issue its own paper money. Any state could put tariffs on trade between other states or countries. There was no system of national courts. Congress could declare war and raise an army, but it could not force the states to give men or money. After the Revolutionary War, the country went into a deep post-war depression. The states were threatening war with each other, and there were armed uprisings and riots across the land. Things eventually got so bad that the country was on the verge of a civil war. This was called the critical period. Because each state was printing their own money, the value depreciated soon after the war, and many returning soldiers were paid in currency they considered to be worthless. There are stories that some soldiers wallpapered their house with the paper currency. On May 25, 1787, the Continental Congress convened in Philadelphia to decide the fate of the Articles of Confederation, and on September 17, 1787, a new constitution was approved, which had the much-needed, stronger central powers. Stay tuned for more Civics Minute segments as you listen to your favorite Coffee Party USA Block Talk radio shows. From Paducah, Kentucky, this is John Cashin. Good day, everyone.
There you go. Civics Minutes on the Articles of the Confederation. And, you know, strong central government versus states' rights is obviously something that, you know, it goes... I think it goes in cycles. I think we see it go in cycles, and I think that you know, maybe we're about to see a cycle that maybe swings back to the states. Maybe people are just fed up with the federal government that has been bought by special interests and big money, which is of course the main thing that Coffee Party is fighting against. And I've actually heard several people espouse that that might be a good way to get the influence or to at least lessen the influence of big money is to take away rights or away, I should say, power from the central government, from our federal government, and give it back to the states. Although the states do the silly things as well. I mean, one of the things you just heard was from Bob, and Bob talked about a big tax break that was just given to Boeing. And if he's okay with it, I'm going to open his mic because I want to ask him. I think I know what it was for. So, Bob, if you don't mind, I don't know if you can hear me, but I'm going to go ahead and open your mic again.
Yeah, I can hear you.
So I know I read an article a couple of weeks ago that they were looking to move the production of the newest, I think it's the 787, that they were potentially looking at building it out of Washington. And they were, of course, shopping around, and, of course, that's one of the things states do that constantly screw each other, right, is that they give these humongous tax breaks just so that they can say, look, we created jobs. But when you look at the net effect on the economy, it's often, you know, not in those states' best interest. Is that what that break was for? Did they settle on building that?
You know, I hate to be a bad student about this. I didn't read deeply into any articles, and I apologize for that. But, hey, you know, it's one nice thing about Google. You can jump into Google and you can go find articles. You know, the Seattle Times would be your best choice because, obviously, that's the newspaper from right around here. But my understanding from what I did understand about it was that, yeah, you are correct. They were shopping around other states. They were going to move something. They wanted it to stay here. I know that was part of it. My understanding is also there's something else tied to it. I don't know if that was true or not, if this is true or not, so please don't quote me. As a good librarian, I always say, don't believe what I'm telling you. Find out for yourself. I'm just giving you some suggestions from what I understand. But I think there was also some tying together with moving their employees' benefits. They wanted to make a different cut back on pension plans and kind of make them have people buy into, you know, strictly 401 type plans. I think that was in there somewhere too. I know the machinists were going to be voting on that. I'm not exactly sure how. All I remember was that Boeing received a really, really, really big tax break. Supposedly, it's keeping jobs here, so they can build here. You know, so they can continue building whatever it was that they were building here. But after that, I just didn't really read a lot. I had a little bone to pick years ago when I was teaching full time, back in 1998. We had an initiative here in the state of Washington, and there were two pieces there were two separate initiatives. One was to give public employee teachers a cost of living increase. And initiatives up here in Washington State last for 3 years, and then after 3 years, you know, you can dump them. Or they can be changed at the stroke of a pen before you get to the third year. That particular initiative was passed by 73%. It was either 72 or 73%. It was the highest ever initiative that was ever passed in the state of Washington for cost of living for teachers. And there was another piece, another initiative. I don't remember the two numbers. I'm sorry, but I believe it was 1998. The other one was they wanted to reduce class sizes, so they're going to start, you know, dumping more money in, hiring more teachers, so we could reduce class sizes. 2 years later, Gary Locke did just what they did again, or did what they just did here lately: massive tax break for Boeing, scrubbed the initiatives. I think we saw 1 year of a living cost of living wage. Might have been 2 years, but I know it didn't reach three, because that was when I learned about initiatives. It's like, well, it's an initiative. It only lasts for 3 years, and then it can keep going, or you can just stroke it out with a pen, and it's pretty much gone. I'm not exactly sure how that works. But anyway, so, yes, just mentioning back what you just said, yeah, it's a huge tax burden, but you know, what does that do for? We're just talking about revenue. What does that do for our revenue? You know, I mean, is it going to help revenue in this state? I don't know. Seems like
you'd like to look at the long term effect, and you know, I know that with anytime
right.
they talk about sports teams and bringing sports teams into town or building new stadiums, they always talk about all the other revenue that supposedly comes in.
I have a pretty sore spot about that too. You know, there used to be this thing called the Kingdome here in Seattle, and then they wanted to build two new places. They wanted to build a baseball place to play outside. All right, they wanted to build a new football stadium. Well, the first one was was the baseball field. I can't remember which was built first, if it was the football stadium or the baseball stadium. Anyway, there was still $17 million owed on the kingdom. They slapped it. They passed. It worked for the baseball team and the football team. I think they asked for a little revenue from. They put a small tax. They put a small tax on to, I believe it was. Hotels, like if a hotel had like less than 60 rooms or something like that, they got a little increase. I think there was an increase on on like sin tax, like some sort of eating restaurant, something like that, a small. But the bottom line is, when you give money like that to a private organization, the NFL or Major League Baseball, that's free money. They're not borrowing that money. That's free money. I don't like that.
I hear you.
Private organizations should be able to operate that way. Now, I learned this about the NFL. Did you know that the NFL, NHL, and
not-for-profit.
Are non-for-profits? I did not know that. Same with golf.
Yes.
I didn't
not-for-profit
know
that. With that literally take in hundreds of millions of dollars a year. Yeah, not-for-profit.
Right.
Then they claim that they distribute it back amongst the teams, right?
You got guys that make tons of money, and I'm sure that there's a lot of programs where they're dumping some sort of money in. But I don't know. I don't understand. There was a great book, and I wish I had the title of it because it jumped in my head as soon as you said that. It was written a few years ago, but I can't think of the title of it. I'm really sorry, but it speaks to how these states are, or how professional football, professional basketball, baseball, how they hold cities hostage and say, if you're not going to come up with this money for us, then we're going to leave. Now, that happened to Seattle. Now, I love the NFL. I like college football a lot better, but I do love NFL football. But that happened to Seattle. We lost the Seattle Seahawks because they won $300 million of tax-based money, build a brand new stadium. The legislature said, no, we're not doing it. They left. They went to Kansas City. A couple of, when they built the football
stadium.
Hold on.
I consider myself a pretty big football fan. So the Kansas City Chiefs were
are you talking about
back in the old days of the AFL?
No. Excuse me. I'm sorry. I got a little I got off track there.
You're talking about your basketball team that ended up going to Oklahoma City.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Now you're perpetuating the stereotype that
the guys who are librarians aren't big sports fans. Now come on.
No, I'm a big sports fan. So is my dad. My dad was a school librarian for 34 years. But here's something interesting that people might want to go look up. You can go look it up. When they were building the football stadium for the Seahawks, that thing got voted down, I think, twice. Oh, excuse me. God, I'm really messing up. I believe it was the baseball stadium first. I'll tell you what.
Don't worry about it, because let me fill in, because I can fill in the blanks.
But this is what happened. We put it on the ballot twice, at least twice, maybe three times. It was voted down every time. They went down and cried to the legislature, and the legislature said, we're going to do it anyway. That wasn't very good, but it happened.
That's exactly what happened in Chicago, the Chicago White Sox. Who are the Southside team? The Cubs are the city's darlings, but the Southside,
right.
It used to be split 50-50, right. And then the Southside is the deteriorating part of town. It's the town that economically is not doing well, so the Sox fan base went away. People moved over to the North Side, which became Cubs fans, and so the Sox did the exact same thing. They were going to be the Florida Marlins. They were going to leave, and they said, build us a new stadium. Because the old Comiskey Park was falling down, they said, build this new stadium. They put it on a referendum. It got crushed. And then a month later, it's like, look, we found the money. And they said we're going to do it anyway. But
the money.
Coming in Chicago, you don't ask those questions.
I understand. You know, when I look around, when it was here, when they said that the Sonics were going to leave, I was like, well, hold it. We got Microsoft, we got Boeing, we have Nintendo, you know, some other big ticket companies up in this state. You know, this state's a pretty good state where we do it. You know, Boeing is huge. Microsoft is gigantic. I mean, those are some big money makers. And, you know, you think with all that money that they have, they wanted $300 million. I'm thinking, why aren't those companies stepping up and, you know, pumping it in and saying, hey, you know, this is for the state of Washington. We have hometown pride, blah, 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 on and on. But they don't. And that's why I don't like what I was talking about earlier. I keep wanting to say anarchists, but it's not aristocracies. Because if an aristocracy doesn't like something, then everybody else suffers. And that's just not good. They wanted to get some ownership from a couple of these guys. I think they call it the Ballmer Group. They were the people that were supposed to do something with this basketball stadium that they're still trying to put up.
Yeah, they made a play for the LA Clippers.
Right, but yet they want to get it. But they go down to the legislature to beg for free tax money. I mean, I'm a graduate student. I'm not getting any free tax money, and I'm getting smarter, and I'm going to be contributing too. I mean, I can't get it. So I kind of have a pretty poor bone to pick with Major League sports because we're subsidizing their profits.
And you talk about, you know, what Egberto's saying about you're only, what are you really worth? I mean, is a guy that can throw a baseball 100 miles an hour really worth $100 million? Is he really? Where's the payback on my $100 million?
That's what kills me. And the first time I heard it was from somebody back east. My mom was from Massachusetts. I mean, I have a bunch of great friends that live in Jersey and Philly and because of the military. And it's so much different back there. I mean, people, you know, you really get the what for. People really let you know. It's not that they don't like you, but they will say things into your face. And, I mean, it's really straightforward, and I loved it. But anyway, it was some NFL football team a couple of years ago. I was listening to some, you know, radio show, and it was back east. I don't know who it was. I can't remember. Anyway, some guy called in, and he was bawling his eyes out. And the guy on the radio says, hey, look, buddy, even if your team does win the title, you're still hitting up in the morning. You're still punching the clock. You ain't getting nothing out of the deal. They might throw you a parade, but you ain't getting nothing out of the deal. And that hit
no,
me.
No, and what – They get to go buy brand new $170 jerseys that
right.
used to cost, you know, $40, but now they're licensed. So
right.
And where does all that
and
money go to?
To
the league.
It has some dude's name on the back of your shoulders, and then when that guy gets traded, it's worthless. I mean, there's absolutely no – I mean, professional sports does – I mean, it's great entertainment, but it's been so inflated with money. It's just gotten so ridiculous. It's hard to say. There's really no loyalty. Hardly anybody ever stays on the same team. But when they go and cry and beg and ask state legislatures to step up and give them, you know, $200, $300 million – that's free money because they ain't borrowing it. It's free money.
No. I hear about. Got another caller on hold.
Okay.
Waiting
hey,
to jump
thanks
in.
So. Yeah. Hey, thanks so much for letting me talk with you. It was great talking with you guys.
Always fun. And I drew you into the conversation, so no need to apologize. I always appreciate the time and the information and the good talk. But right now I've got 412, this should be our good friend of the show, Greg Russick, calling in. How are you tonight, Greg?
Is this Tony Kornheiser?
You know, you had to go there. Have I ever told you he is my least favorite one of my least favorite human beings on the planet.
Ooh, that's right.
Yeah, I mean,
that's
he
harsh.
Was what he did post Katrina. All right, now I got to tell you the story.
I'm living in Atlanta.
It's the first Monday Night Football game that Atlanta's on. They're playing the Saints, and it's the first Saints home game since Katrina, right? I mean, obviously, it took a long time to clean up the Superdome, right? So it's their first home game. This guy brings on, at halftime, Spike Lee. Is now egging him on to slam the Bush administration and FEMA for their horrible efforts post-Katrina. To his credit, Spike Lee didn't bite. He said, let's not talk about that now. Let's just talk about what we're going to do to get the people of New Orleans back on their feet. And I was like, so at one moment, I was like, Tony Kornheiser, check, you're done. And Spike Lee, good for you.
All right. Well, there's the Tony Kornheiser story. That's good.
That's good.
So, I caught bits and pieces of the show, and I was curious to get your take on 2014. It seems like every half hour or so, the wind starts to blow in a different direction. There's a brand new crisis that everybody wants to draw attention to on both sides and use it as a reason for counting out the other party. And we're actually now, you know, starting to kind of come down to, you know, some serious campaign season, perhaps after the first of the year, right? Because the elections will be in November, year from now, right?
Yep.
So, I try not to live in a bubble. I know it's easy to do, and I do gravitate towards certain sources, Coffee Party being one of them. But I think all things being equal, there probably isn't going to be a huge change in the makeup, really, of either house. And a lot of that goes back to the gerrymandering that has occurred and the fact that, you know, there are very few really competitive places and races that could create any sort of real significant change. And most of that goes back to what we were talking about earlier, I think, with Egberto, and that is that the majority of Americans aren't really all that well informed. In fact, they're grossly uninformed, and some of them are abysmally misinformed. And so it's not likely that there's going to be, I don't think, a big change in the makeup. What do you think?
Well, okay, so let me say, there's a whole bunch of things I want to say. First of all, we'll start with my top concern, which is if 90 million people didn't bother showing up in a presidential election, what kind of voter turnout are we going to have? We know that historically the voter turnouts for the midterms are much lower, right? So I'm really, really concerned that voter turnout's going to be low. However, that being said, you have a Congress with an approval rating barely in double digits.
I don't think it is it?
Depending on which poll, it seems to bounce between 9 and 15 somewhere in there. So let's say it's 15. Let's give them the biggest benefit of the doubt we can. Let's say it is. So with 85% of the people pissed off, you really don't think there's a chance for a swing like what we saw in the last election? I mean, it was 69 seats. Was the swing in the last election. People are mad. Why can't we get change?
Well, I think you actually answered your own question in the setup, and that is that it's about voter apathy. And while we, people like you and I and folks who are kind of, engaged on a regular basis in this kind of stuff are following it, but the people who are going to vote in November 2014 are the people who would vote in almost any election. It's going to, the voter turnout, I think, will be even less than it is in a presidential year, which means only the partisans are going to be voting. And there are very few, even fewer than normal, kind of independent voters who might swing an electoral district one way or the other. That's my that's my prediction. It's a bit cynical, and I'd like it to be just the opposite. And I think sometimes that we convince ourselves that everybody's as up to speed, up to date, and engaged as we are. I know I sound probably kind of elitist to people. I'm not trying to be that. I'm just saying that this is my hobby, man. I don't collect stamps, and I don't go hunting. I'm a political and news junkie, so I follow this stuff. So do you. We know what's going on. We're paying attention to it. But our brothers and sisters are watching some singing show right now. That's what's going on, right? That some talent was on or some reality show is on or the Monday Night Football game is on. That's what most Americans are doing.
No, I didn't even know who's playing. Is it a compelling game? We're back to sports. I'm just kidding. Wait a second. And I don't mean to ask you this to put you on the spot, but doesn't your assertion fly a little bit in the face of the data you had sent me about a month ago as a result of a survey? I thought nearly 36% of the people had identified as independents now.
That may be the case. I'm not suggesting that mathematically that's not a possibility here. That a third of the voting population considers themselves to be independent and considers themselves to be in the center. That doesn't mean they're going to go vote.
Okay. Well, I'll have to go back and look at that. Most political polls I follow start with the statement, X number of likely voters polled said. Now, I don't know how they determine likely voters. I mean, I don't think you have to prove yourself to the survey people, and maybe, but supposedly these are somewhat scientific things that have plus or minus of 3 to 5%. And so maybe to your cynical, I'm being too optimistic, but it just seems to me that there's a perfect storm out here. There's a central issue which the country is really divided on, right?
Right.
Or at least that's what they're keeping central. But pretty soon, when the campaigns start, there's going to be a lot of other issues that are going to be people are going to be reminded of, right? And it is sad to think that we as Americans, or at least the media, thinks we can only keep one conversation going at a time. Right. Remember Sandy Hook? So then we had gun control for 6 months. You haven't heard anything on gun control in 6 months, have you?
We're coming up on the anniversary of the Newtown shooting in
Senate. Yeah, and nobody's talking about gun control. It went to the Senate. They beat it, and boom, it's done.
Well,
I'm more hopeful than you.
I hope you're right, and I hope I'm wrong. I was looking
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but here's on the point of the topic of the show, and I'm glad you called because you of all people don't mind standing up and saying, I don't like Republicans, I'm pretty much voting Democrat all the time, and that's, so you're in tune with the Democratic Party. the premise of the show was, are they going to come out, talking about economics, are they going to come out and embrace the word redistribution, as opposed to what President Obama did in 2011, which was to run away from that word, to try to talk circles around that word, to try to label it something other than that word. Are they going to embrace this finally and go move back to what the Democrats always were, which is the party of the people?
So the answer I think is no, they are not going. They are the Democratic Party is not going to embrace the word or the concept of redistribution. And the reason for that, I think, is twofold. One is it's political poison. There's almost no way in today's current climate for any politician to be able to successfully spin the what I would call the classic or traditional definition of redistribution. That's one reason. The second reason is actually, I think, is much more defensible, and that is I think that word carries with it a connotation that actually is not what I'm for, and I don't think is what most people are for. I'm not talking about taking anything away from anyone and giving it to someone else. What what the notion of a tax increase on the wealthy is not a redistribution of that wealth to the poor. It's the charge that the wealthy should be paying in order to maintain the kind of society and civilization that we live in that has allowed them to accrue that wealth. That's the premise that is lost in the Democratic Party today, and that, frankly, if it was me, the way I'd be campaigning for this wouldn't be on the notion of redistribution. If your bill has come due, folks, you two percenters, you are in the 2% because of what this country and what this society has provided to you. And you owe it to the rest of us to pay for it. The bill is now due. You need to pay for the infrastructure that moves your goods and services. It also moves you and your employees around this country and around the globe. You need to pay for programs that raise the standard of living in this country. You need to pay your workers living salaries so that they can actually afford to buy some of the goods and services that you manufacture or that you have imported from low-cost markets overseas in order to keep this consumer-based free market system working. You have hoarded your wealth for too long, and it's now time to pay the piper.
I'm Greg Rusick, and I approve this message. No. here's what I'm saying.
It's not redistribution, Dan. It's not redistribution. That is not anywhere near. No, it's not. Here's why. Redistribution would be to simply go to the wealthy and say, give us your money so we can give it to somebody else. What I'm suggesting is that money needs to be invested back into this nation. That's what's missing. You talked about it earlier. Apple Computer has what, $6 billion sitting in an Irish bank account that hasn't been taxed by anybody? Those are the kinds of things that have to come to an end. It simply isn't fair.
I'm not disagreeing with you, and I kind of understand your textbook definition of redistribution and why that might be a bad word. You're saying, okay. All right, that's fine. But here's I can't escape the math. And here's the math. The last time I looked, I believe it was if you looked at six-figure income or higher, it was 10% of the population. 10% of the country makes six figures or higher. So if you push that up to, say, what President Obama was saying, $250,000, now you're talking about 3%?
Yeah, you're more
4%
in the 2%
max?
Range. 2%
okay.
range.
So if somebody was to go out and campaign and saying, we're going to raise taxes on those people and give your impassioned speech about the bill is due, it's time to pay back,
right?
Shouldn't you have 96% of the voters going, yeah?
Yeah, you should.
I mean,
right.
Shouldn't that pass in a landslide?
Yes, it should. Yes, it should.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. Are you asking me why I wouldn't? I can keep you on this topic for the rest of your show. The reason it won't is because half of the population votes against their own economic self-interest because they have, I hate to use this term because it really is unkind, but I can't think of a better one. They have been duped by the Republican Party into believing the lies of trickle-down economics.
After 30 years of failure and after 30 years of income inequality,
yeah,
and after the last crash of 08, you
right.
really think that those things are not enough to collapse the I don't know, what do you want to call it, collapse the pretty facade that's been built in front of the rundown piece of garbage is hiding behind it.
Here's
trickle-down economics.
I dream of these kinds of days just like you do, that people would take facts on face value, that they wouldn't try to rewrite history. that they put aside their hero worship of people like Ronald Reagan and accept the truth, and that is that we have been living under a failed experiment for 30 years. It's, you know, there are lots of characters that have come in and out of this play over that time, and you know, I will include Bill Clinton in that scenario as well. He is the guy who signed into law the Republican Congress passed legislation to kill the Glass-Steagall Act and to deregulate the financial services industry. You can tie a lot of our problems right to that day that he put pen to paper. So there, you know, it's not just one party or just one president. But we've gotten to a point now, Dan, where anybody who wants to subscribe to an ideology can do so very simply, very easily, by either watching Fox News or MSNBC, and they can find whatever they want to corroborate and substantiate their beliefs on the Internet. And they've got politicians in Washington, D.C., who will tell them precisely what it is that they want to hear, that the American dream depends on small government, low taxes, and less regulation, and you can be a part of that dream too someday. All you have to do is pull yourself up by your bootstraps, work hard, pay your dues, play by the rules, and that can be yours too. And that's the other lie that has been sold to the American public for generations. It's a lie.
Well, yeah, I mean, but now I got to go here.
Here's what we don't have. Here's what we don't have today, Dan. We've had this conversation before too. We don't have a Democratic Party in the mold of FDR. We've got a Republican Party in the Democrats, and then we've got a party that's in the crazy house, off the rails, gone, not even in left fields. They're out in the parking lot. The Republican Party is a shame and a shambles of what it once was. It's not even close to what it used to be.
Yes.
So now what you have is you got Democrats acting like Republicans. You got Democrats who are following the money just like the Republicans do, but not standing on any sort of principles that the Democratic Party actually used to stand on.
Right. Isn't the correct question to ask these people, are you better off than you were 30 years ago?
Than you were 30 years ago. Well, you're going to be crossing over some generational lines. You're going to have some.
Okay, maybe that's too much. Are you better off than you were in 2008?
what they need to be doing, yeah, that's a good one. You could ask that question, right? But here's the better one, especially people of our age. Are you doing better than your parents? Do you expect to? How will your kids do compared to you and your parents?
No, I agree with you fully. Now I'm going to have to go look it up, but I can't. I'm not a multitasker, so I can't do it. So I'm going to have to go look up polling data on whether people really believe in the American dream or the American dream is alive anymore. I just find it really hard after the last 5 years of futility since the crash, where people have seen downward mobility as the rule and not the exception. I just have such a hard time believing that some guy who had a middle-class job, who's now working, you know, double shifts at McDonald's to try to make ends meet, really believes that one day he'll have a chance to own that McDonald's franchise. I just find it hard to believe.
Well, frankly, I mean, I think, again, I don't mean to sound like time, but only a fool would believe that.
Right.
Only someone of extraordinary luck would actually have an opportunity to be that person. The idea, you know, this mythology that somebody could, you know, start off making $7.25 an hour flipping burgers in a McDonald's and then someday become Ray Kroc. You know, the reason those stories stand out for us in this society is because they are so rare. They are like Greek mythology. There's only one or two of them. You know, this notion that you can somehow catapult yourself into the upper class simply by working hard and playing by the rules, it's almost the complete opposite of that. It's almost the, it's almost, you know, the only way you almost get there is by doing exactly the opposite of that.
I'm not going to remember his name, but there's an economist who runs around, and he says that that the old model, being capitalism, is no longer viable. And he talks about the history of the country, and he said the history of this country, it has one unique, well, it has many unique things, but one of the most unique things about the history of this country is that for the first 170 years it existed, wages grew. Wages increased. People made more money than they did before. He said that stopped back in the 70s. That's when it stopped. And he goes, that's when we should have known something's wrong.
Right.
But everybody just assumed that because there were some guys that got rich in the dot-com era and some guys got rich off of, you know, Wall Street, and some people got rich, you know, that, hey, well, then that could be me too. But at this point, I just can't see how people would still believe that. So
well,
now I've
got
to ask you the question I asked Ed Berto.
Yeah.
Democracy only works if you trust the guy who's pulling the lever next to you. And if you're telling me, Greg Rusick, that half the people in this country have been duped, and I'll never, ever, ever blame the duper. I blame the dupee. I would rephrase. I would say they have allowed themselves to be duped because the information's there and anybody can get it. So, but the point is, if we don't trust every other person that's going into a polling booth, then
right.
Do we have to question the entire form of government we have?
Yes, we do. Yeah, and this is the other part that most Americans don't like to hear, because, you know, we have this ingrained sense of exceptionalism that we can't even entertain the thought and the possibility that maybe ours is not the best, that maybe there are changes after 200 and, you know, however many years it is, 240 years, 250 years, that maybe there are some changes that need to be made to the way in which our government is conducted. And as you well know, one of the key ingredients to that, one of the most expedient things we could easily do, is to get money out of politics. It sounds hard, but it's not. The more I look into this, the more I'm convinced that it's eminently doable if more people just paid attention to what can be accomplished while we work on amending the Constitution. There are steps along the way that can be taken. And you know I'm going to talk about the American Anti-Corruption. If people would just pay 10 minutes of attention to that idea and sign on to it, we don't need every adult in America. We only need a few million adults in America for this to be able to get the kind of attention and attraction that it ought to be getting from lots of media outlets all over the place. And then, yeah, this is one of those things that I can't see how anybody would disagree with the idea that somehow we as citizens of the United States ought not to know where the money is coming from that's going to finance political campaigns and political marketing. How could anyone say we shouldn't know whose money that is? How would anybody be able to defend that notion if, in fact, as you just said, we need to be able to trust the guy next? That to me is one of the simplest and most effective things we can do, is to get support behind a notion that reveals where the money is coming from and then put some reasonable limitations around. Because you and I both know my $25 contribution doesn't count for anything next to Sheldon Adelson's $25
million. I agree.
Right. So the answer
unless you can find the right aggregator.
Right, aggregator.
Who could take your 25 and my 25 and put them all together. And that's what the NRA does. The NRA is a very successful aggregator of money. That's what all specialists, that's what unions do. They're very good aggregators. And they can go there and say, with lots of big checks, and say, here's lots of voters that want to know what you think. And then all of a sudden they can get attention. But you and I individually, not so much.
I really wish someone from, you know, with a different opinion or, you know, with a different viewpoint would call in and help to educate me on why none of this is you know, worthwhile or valid. I really do.
Yeah, we need to. You know what? I'm thinking that we need to identify and get like a panel, right? We need like three libertarians and three Democrats and three Republicans and three Tea Partiers and three Greens and three. We need to somehow get, you know, rotating panels, and that way we could have all the different viewpoints. That would be really cool. I just can't figure out how to do it.
Yeah.
Without paying people. I mean, if I could pay people.
Yeah, right.
Darn, there's that money thing again.
So again, just kind of back to your question. It didn't sound like it was rhetorical, so I'm going to go ahead and answer it. Do I trust the guy in the booth next to me? No. Half of them I don't. I think they're going in without any sort of real information, without any real intelligence about what the issues are, what the candidates stand for, and what is actually best for them and their family and their neighbors. Again, I will stand firm on this until somebody can convince me otherwise. If you don't make $250,000 a year and you vote for Republican, any Republican, you are voting against your own interests.
Well, economic, for sure. And I think, yeah. I've always espoused that, and so I don't really want, you know, I'm beating the dead horse here, but I think what they do is they get those people to vote on non-economic issues.
I'm just going to say the same thing, is that where the Republican Party is also doing a horrendously successful job, I guess is one way to say it, is dividing the country on social issues, which in my mind are, you know, they're equally important. I can't imagine how anyone, any sane, rational, mature adult in this country thinks that we ought to be legislating, you know, who can marry whom. That's a perfect example. Why is that even a talking point, let alone an issue on a ballot? I don't get that at all. The only explanation is hatred and bigotry. It comes down to that. If you think the law ought to tell two people they can't get married, you're a bigot. You're a hater. There's no other way to describe it. And so if that's the person who's standing in the voting booth next to me, yeah, I don't like this system anymore. I don't want them casting a vote.
We need to go back to intelligence testing for voting. Yeah, you have to take.
It's nice.
That was tried before, and that didn't work out very well. Literary test, yeah.
Yeah. I don't pretend to not be taking a strong position on this kind of stuff, but it's because it's that important. So
maybe Egberto is actually right, and maybe this is a general failing of the coffee party, and I hate to throw it out there. But, you know, Egberto's tagline on his blogs and his email has said for the longest time, we need it's something to the effect of we need to incite class warfare. And I go back to thinking, and this is what Bob was saying, we don't want aristocracies, and we don't want to be the people who are pounding at the outside of the castle walls going, give me food, because we're starving out here, right? But if you think about it, and I know I've had this conversation with Bobby many times, is that the end game? Do these people build their gated communities, hire their own police, hire their own firemen, build their own schools, do they build the castles, and do they live inside them while the rest of us just go to hell? And if so, at some point, 300 million people rise up and say enough is enough. Is that where we're? I mean, isn't that where we're headed? If this doesn't change?
Yes, I think in some respects, yeah, absolutely. It may not look the same as the French Revolution. And there may not be people with, you know, heads rolling in the streets, but if the inequality gap continues like it is today, you know, Bob Dylan wrote a lot of really good songs, and one of my favorite lines in one of his songs is, "When you ain't got nothing, you got nothing to lose." think about what's happening in some places around the world. I'll tell you what I'm amazed about right now is that the Spanish youth, for instance, have not started to burn cities. 50% of the youth in Spain right now, I think by some accounts, are unemployed. You know what? When you don't have anything, you're going to start taking from people who have it. That's what's going to happen. And I'm not suggesting that that's going to happen anytime soon in the United States. And there's plenty of militarized police. We saw what happened in Boston when two whack jobs, set off a couple of bombs. That looked like that. In a matter of hours, Boston looked like Beirut. Boston looked like a militarized zone. Where did those people come from in tanks and body armor and attack equipment? Is that a police force or is that a military?
There's no doubt. But here's my hope. My hope is that they don't take it to the streets, they take it to the booth. And that eventually if enough people get angry, because and what it is now it's not a matter of informing those people, those people who have allowed themselves to be duped. It's not a matter of informing those people who just say forget it and they just totally disengage with the process. But at some point, it's when you have anger to that extent, it's contagious. It's in the air. And you get that mob rule. And people go, I don't know what I'm mad about, but I'm going to do something about it. So can't we just rile up people enough to get mad enough so they go to the booth and do it in the booth so we don't have to have a French Revolution?
Yes, we need to get people that upset, but before they get that hungry and don't have a place to live, right? Before that wealth redistribution happens to such a degree, we continue to race to the bottom. And large percentages, I think it's 1 in 5 children in the United States live in poverty.
Yep.
1 in 5.
Yep.
1 in 5. What happens, Dan, when 20% of the adult population has grown up in abject poverty? And I'm talking poverty means in the United States, you could be a family of 6 making less than 30 grand a year. That's poverty. You can't make 30 grand a year working 40 hours a week at Walmart. You only make 14. What's going to happen when those people get old? It could get awfully nasty. And so what we really need right now are political leaders who are willing to stand up against the man and against the machine. We need a whole Congress full of Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, and Alan Grace. I know that's going to sound like a nutcase talking to a lot of people on the right, but those are the people who, to me, get the closest to speaking the truth. And that is that big money has corrupted America. And until big money is put back in its place, it's only going to get worse for us. It's fine for them. They got no worries, man. No worries. Robert Reich.
So,
I'd vote for him.
Yeah, no, I agree. I'm finding more and more of him. We talked about a gentleman that was actually just here in Portland doing his radio
Hartman.
Show from a bookstore.
Tom
Tom Hartman. I was heartbroken.
I've been a fan of his for years.
I was heartbroken, but I got to support my Winterhawks. I know that was an awfully selfish thing of me to do. I should have probably done my civic duty and gone and met Tom Hartman. Not that I would have met him, but I mean, I'll have to catch up with him down the road. But there's a lot of these people, Joseph Stiglitz, there's tons of economists that are all saying the same thing. It's just that there doesn't seem to be a lot of people listening, and there certainly doesn't seem to be a lot of politicians agreeing with them and claiming they're going to change. So you're saying it's possible, but it's just not going to happen in 2014.
Oh no, I don't think. Yes, I would love to think, and I still do actually hold out on a thin thread of hope that 2014 actually could, if enough people got out and voted. If some of the disenfranchised people that you talk about, the 90 million that didn't vote, if just some of those people went to the polls So, you know what? Those are the people who actually probably are paying some attention and are just fed up with the lack of distinction between the choices, because there isn't really that much difference between. Again, I'm in my 50s. I look at the Democratic Party and I say, these guys are Republicans I used to not vote for 25 years ago. The Republican Party isn't even on the radar. They're flipped so far off the screen right now. There's only a small chance of them starting to come back now that some of the call them, pejoratively the established Republicans are starting to call the Tea Party out for who they are. Crazy. Some of that might start to come back. I'd like to see 2014 be a big shift. I'd love to see both houses of Congress go back to the Democrats. I'd love to see the House go back. It's not going to happen, but I'd love to see it happen.
Okay. Well, on that little pessimistic note, I will thank you, as always, for your wonderful contribution and bid you adieu while I take care of some show business.
Have a good
week.
Because,
of course, there is no business like show business.
Have a good week.
Thanks, Greg. Appreciate it. Greg Rusick, big-time contributor, as always, and welcome guest, as always. Chiming in with his thoughts on 2014. So that is the show for tonight. I want to thank everybody who participated from everywhere from Maryland to Bob in Seattle to Greg out in Pittsburgh. Again, I apologize about the lack of Facebook publicity about the show, but apparently that will be up and running. And again, by the end of the day today, and we should be back on the air and maybe sending a lot of angry letters to Facebook. But nonetheless, my name is Dan Aronson. I host Press One for Democracy every Monday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 6 p.m. Pacific Time. On Tuesdays, we have a show that's currently on hiatus, The Middle Ground, but it will be returning shortly after after the new year. And that's with Coffee Party President Eric Beiler at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. On Thursdays, we have Janine Loudon, Debbie Lynn Molyneux hosting Lunch with Loudon at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, noon Pacific Time. And then on Saturdays, we have Egberto Willis with Politics Done Right at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And then our brand new Coffee Party show that starts Sunday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and that is our new friends who are progressives from 10, and I'm going to forget the name again. They always use the abbreviation. Progressive Politics Tennessee Style. There you go, Progressive Politics Tennessee Style, and that starts every Sunday at 2 p.m. So for me, Dan Aronson, your host of Press One for Democracy, thank you very much for listening, whether you're doing it live or whether you're doing it recorded, and I will see you all next Monday night. Thanks for listening.